breaking point. This past week, the mayor of Chicago called for calm as excruciating body camera footage was released in the police killing of a 13-year-old teenager, Adam Toledo. The shaky video shows a police officer responding to a call of shots fired, chasing a boy with what appears to be a gun down an alley at night in a predominantly Latino neighborhood. "Stop right now," the police officer screams whilst cursing. "Hands, show me your hands, drop it, drop it." A single shot fells the boy as he turns, lifting his hands. Other recent lethal force incidents have rocked communities large and small. Michael Leon Hughes, a 32-year-old, a black man shot to death on 30th of March after the police said he used a taser on a Jacksonville police officer responding to a domestic dispute in a motel. Aaron Mamba Sycap, a 16-year-old, a Pacific Islander, killed on 5th of April as he fled from the Honolulu police in a stolen Honda Civic. And Anthony Thompson Jr., a 17-year-old black teenager in Knoxville, Tennessee, killed by police on 12th of April in a high school bathroom after reports that a student had brought a gun onto the campus. All of those killings and many more occurred as testimony in the Minneapolis trial unfolded, though few attracted as much national attention as the shooting of Daunte Wright, less than 10 miles from the courthouse where Derek Chauvin stood trial. Protests erupted in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, after a veteran police officer fatally shot Daunte Wright, saying she mistook her gun for her taser as he attempted to flee during a traffic stop. Abigail Serra, a Minneapolis civil rights lawyer and member of the Minneapolis Police Conduct Oversight Commission, said it was unclear why the police officers stopped him for an expired registration, an issue for many drivers in the state during the coronavirus pandemic. But two aspects of the case, she said, were infuriatingly familiar: that Daunte Wright was black, and that the police tasked with delivering him safely to the courts of law, where violations of the law are supposed to be adjudicated, effectively delivered a death sentence. It's just another example of a nothing offense escalated to lethality, Ms. Serra said. Though many of these killings have a familiar ring, it is unfair to blame them all on law enforcement, said Patrick Yose, a retired sheriff's office captain and president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. "In a lot of cities, it has to do with people feeling hopeless," he said. "It's poverty, it's a failing education system, it's all of these things that are vitally important to stability of a community. That instability often places police officers in situations in which they confront individuals who may be dangerous and non-compliant," he said. "Part of the reason society has been unable to prevent deadly encounters between law enforcement and the community is that some people are unwilling to discuss the real challenges of crime that police officers sometimes encounter," he said. "There's just so many factors that people have already made up their minds, and they think that law enforcement is based off of race," Mr. Yose continued. "Federal and state laws generally hold that police officers are justified in using lethal force as long as they have a reasonable fear of imminent injury or death for themselves or another person. And jurors tend not to second-guess what might be reasonable force in the moment. Of the 64 fatal encounters compiled by the New York Times for the past 3 weeks, at least 42 cases involve people accused of wielding firearms. More than a dozen involve confrontations with people who were mentally ill or in the throes of a breakdown. And at least 10 cases arose as the police responded to reports of domestic violence. Since at least 2013, with a slight dip because of the coronavirus pandemic, about 1,100 people have been killed each year by police officers, according to databases compiled by Mapping Police Violence, a research and advocacy group that examines all such killings, including non-gun related deaths such as George Floyd's. The Washington Post, whose numbers are limited to police shootings, reflect a similarly flat trend line. Nearly all of the victims since 29th of March this year have been men, with black or Latino people substantially overrepresented, a pattern that reflects broader criminal justice research. And most were under the age of 30. Four were teenagers. Philip Stinson, a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University who studies civilian killings by members of law enforcement, said the most striking aspect of the statistics on lethal police force is how little the numbers have changed over the last decade or two since researchers began to comprehensively track them. Dr. Philip Stinson added, "Even as cell phone videos and body cameras make it harder to hide human error and abuses of authority by law enforcement, and even as social media amplifies public outrage, only about 1.1% of police officers who kill civilians are actually charged with murder or manslaughter."
The war in Afghanistan has been a major foreign policy challenge for several U.S. presidents. The war, which began in 2001 under former President George W. Bush, has killed some 2,300 U.S. troops and cost American taxpayers more than $2 trillion. The protracted conflict has been widely described as futile. This week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that America will finally withdraw all of its forces from Afghanistan in 2021.
"After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home."
Several thousand American forces remain part of the 9,600-strong NATO mission there. Under Biden's plan, the withdrawal is scheduled to begin on May the 1st and will be completed in September. The U.S. president seems confident about his withdrawal plan, but his initiative has been met with criticism. The Taliban called for the U.S. to abide by an agreement with the group, which was brokered in Doha, Qatar, last year. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump had agreed to pull out all troops from Afghanistan by May the 1st. The militant group warned that if the Doha agreement is breached, those who fail to comply with the deal will be held responsible for any possible problems. Russia's foreign ministry also said the newly announced withdrawal strategy violates America's previous promises. Meanwhile, the pullout plan comes at a time when Taliban militants are in control of large parts of Afghanistan after nearly two decades of the U.S.-led war against them. The almost 20-year war has wreaked havoc in Afghanistan and claimed tens of thousands of lives. Taliban militants who were forced out of power by the U.S. invasion in 2001 proved resilient and clawed back large parts of Afghanistan from foreign and government forces, especially in recent years. They are now in control of important parts of the country. They seem to be an indispensable part of Afghanistan's future. Critics of America's foreign policy say this exposes the futility of U.S. militarism in the region.
I believe that this conflict, when you analyze it, the only proper way to state it is that it was a total failure. The United States will try to spin this into a complicated story into saying, you know, it's complicated, nobody, there are no clear winners. But you think about the fact that they did the same similar thing even in Vietnam when the Americans were dealt a sound crushing defeat.
The U.S.-led military campaign failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with a long list of problems such as poverty, unemployment, and illicit opium production. Some even go so far as to call war-torn Afghanistan a failed state. Meanwhile, the insecurity has provided a fertile ground for the growth of militant groups more extreme than the Taliban. Now foreign forces are finally planning to leave. Who is responsible for the mess that they're leaving behind? It's the Afghan people who have to put up with the unending misery every day. The departure of foreign forces this year could mark a new chapter for Afghans. Observers believe Afghans across the country, whether in the ranks of the Taliban or the government, have to put aside their differences and work together if they really want a future for their country.
Tensions are running high between Moscow and Kiev over the latest escalation in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. NATO has expressed concern over Russia's military buildup in the area.
We are seriously concerned by ongoing developments, and NATO is monitoring the situation very closely.
NATO's chief said Russia's move is unjustified. He called on Moscow to end the buildup in and around Ukraine and stop what he called its provocations and de-escalate immediately. Ukraine has also called for sanctions on Russia over the measure.
We need measures which will deter Russia and which will contain its aggressive intentions. This could be, as the Secretary General mentioned, a new round of sanctions which would raise the price of Russian aggression.
Russia, however, has its own argument and has warned against what it calls fueling belligerent sentiment in Ukraine. Moscow accuses the U.S. and other NATO members of turning Ukraine into a, quote, a powder keg by increasing arms supplies to Kiev. It says the military support is a serious challenge to Russia, adding that Moscow would do everything possible to ensure its security. But what is Russia-Ukraine tension all about? A few weeks ago, Moscow deployed troops along the border with Ukraine following reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in Donbas. Moscow accused Kiev of taking provocative measures near its border. In return, Ukraine, the U.S. and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in eastern Ukraine. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. The tension between Russia and Ukraine has drawn reactions from other countries. In a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart in Brussels, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Russia's military buildup very provocative.
The United States stands firmly behind the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, and I'm here to reaffirm that with the foreign minister today. And that's particularly important at a time when we're seeing, unfortunately, Russia take very provocative actions.
Blinken had warned that if Russia acts recklessly or aggressively, there will be consequences. France and Germany have also called on Russia to halt a troop buildup on the border with Ukraine and reaffirm their support for Kiev in its confrontation with Moscow. Meanwhile, foreign ministers of the G7 countries have issued a joint statement calling the movement of Russian troops near the border with Ukraine threatening and destabilizing. But Turkey, a NATO member, had a different stance. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara was working to end the Ukraine-Russia tension while voicing military cooperation and support for Ukraine.
This is a very serious issue. And it seems like escalation comes from Ukrainian and NATO side. For some reason, I suspect the new Biden administration, they want to test Russia and Putin's resolve. Maybe they have a feeling that they can push the situation further. But it's a very kind of naive hope. Basically, what you know, everybody has to be aware that East Ukraine doesn't want to go back. They don't want to obey Kiev. They want to be either on their own or join Russia if that works out. They don't want to be part of Ukraine.
Many believe that the U.S. decision to send warships to the volatile area would complicate the situation.
But that's exactly what it is. I think United States want to test Russia. They also, it's for United States, you know, we have to be aware that we have a change of scenery. Many people who were in State Department and the government who were ousted under Trump, they came back. And they want to resurrect their failed policy vis-a-vis Ukraine. They started the whole thing. They started, this campaign of splitting Ukraine apart, pulling it toward, NATO. So they think that they can, try it. And if, while trying it, they are testing, Putin's resolve, Russian resolve. They also don't have much to lose. It's not their soldiers who are going to get killed there. It'll be either Eastern Ukrainians or Kiev forces will be killed. And then it'll be like the usual scenario, usual script, which we very well know. No matter what happens, Russia will be blamed. New sanctions will be introduced. And among the sanctions, United States love to do the sanctions.
With tensions simmering in eastern Ukraine, U.S. media are happy to push the narrative that Russia is the aggressor and is preparing to invade its neighbor. The reports ignore the fact that the Donetsk and Luhansk republics in eastern Donbass region declared independence from Ukraine back in 2014 in response to a U.S.-backed coup. It seems that the United States, along with its longtime ally NATO, are establishing a united front against Russia. What is certain, however, is that such escalations risk spiraling out of control and sucking all sides into a vortex that would be in no one's favor. It was on Sunday when Iran's nuclear facilities in the central city of Natanz came under another Israeli attack. Israeli media cited intelligence sources as saying it was an Israeli cyber attack. Former Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Moshe Yalon said he hopes no one in Israel would take responsibility for the Natanz incident implicitly. Yalon said there are things for which silence is always beautiful. Spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Behrouz Kamalvandi, said the incident affected part of the electricity distribution network of Natanz. He said the attack caused no casualties or contamination, adding that investigations are underway into the matter. Iran's nuclear chief also reacted. Ali Akbar Salehi condemned the incident as an act of nuclear terrorism. He said the futile and desperate enemy move was aimed at blocking Iran's eye-catching nuclear progress. He called on the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency to respond to the act of terror. Iran's foreign ministry also accused Israel of being the culprit behind the cyber attack on the Natanz nuclear facility, pledging that Tehran will take revenge. Foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh slammed the Israeli sabotage act as an act of nuclear terrorism.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. There has been no casualty or contamination reported, but it could very much resulted in a catastrophic situation. So it can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity.
Khatibzadeh said Iran reserves the right to respond in kind under Article 51 of the UN Charter. The spokesman noted that Tehran has started communications with international authorities in this regard. Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident at Natanz will not slow down Iran's nuclear program and will instead speed up the country's nuclear advancement. He said the centrifuges damaged in the incident were the IR-1 type and that they will be replaced with the most advanced centrifuges Iran has developed. The attack on the Natanz nuclear facility happens on the same day the U.S. Defense Secretary visits Israel for the first time in his capacity.
As a major strategic partner for the United States, our bilateral relationship with Israel in particular is central to regional stability and security in the Middle East. During our meeting, I reaffirmed to Minister Gantz, our commitment to Israel is enduring and it is ironclad.
For many, The visit might be carrying a message.
One has to assume, especially while the defense secretary is visiting Israel, because it would be hugely embarrassing. So the assumption has to be that the U.S. knew this attack was going to take place and did not say not to do it. Otherwise, there would have to be some kind of a protest by the United States to the Israeli government for doing it.
The attack on Natanz nuclear facility is not the first act of terror by the Israeli regime against the Islamic Republic. A blast hit a centrifuge assembly line at Natanz July last year, which Iran described as an act of sabotage. Head of the Israeli agency Yossi Cohen told the New York Times then that Israel had detonated a bomb there. In November 2020, prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran. This, as his name was mentioned multiple times in a presentation in 2018 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear energy program. Netanyahu described the scientist as a director of Iran's nuclear program and threatened, quote, remember that name, Fakhrizadeh. Apart from Fakhrizadeh, a number of other Iranian scientists have fallen victim to the Israeli terrorism. Ardashir Hosseinpour, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan are all on that list. But as far as the Natanz attack is concerned, it came a day after Iran started up several cascades of advanced centrifuges in the facility. The incident also comes at a time when Tehran is holding talks with the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The negotiations are aimed at removing the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, for Israel to do it at this time, the assumption, again, would be that they're trying to mess up those negotiations and make it hard for the United States to come to an agreement with Iran. You know, it'll be harder for the U.S., I imagine, to go back by taking off the sanctions.
All in all, what is almost certain is the fact that Israel will leave no stone unturned to hamper Iran's nuclear advancements by carrying out such acts of terrorism. The regime also tries its best to prevent the United States from reaching a deal with the Islamic Republic to remove the sanctions that have crippled the lives of millions of Iranians. But many are also pointing the finger at the U.S. in the case of the Natanz Sabotage Act and other terrorist attacks by the Israeli regime, arguing Israel doesn't commit such acts of terror without Washington's blessing.
Activists in the U.S. has held rallies in Washington, D.C. to call for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The activists from the Yemeni Liberation Movement have been on hunger strike since March 29th to call on the U.S. government to cease support for Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and draw attention to the plight of millions of Yemenis facing malnutrition and starvation. The protesters say what they're going through doesn't compare with the pain experienced by war-weary Yemenis, but it can raise awareness about the dire humanitarian situation in the Arab nation.
So, as someone who's part of Yemeni Liberation Movement, we believe in self-determination. So for the people of Yemen to determine for themselves the way that they want to live. And they're not able right now to make those decisions because they're actively and violently being starved by the U.S. government and by the Saudi-UAE coalition.
Experts say the fact that a growing number of people in the U.S., including politicians, are now demanding an end to the years-long war is a positive development, but not enough to end the conflict.
Everybody can imagine just how much your health and well-being is impacted. And I do hope that those who are watching and seeing realize that the longer that you all are on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen.
But what steps can the international community take to ensure it can put an end to the deadly crisis. During his first foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden laid out his agenda for the Yemen conflict.
This war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that the Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. Although the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen escalated under former U.S. President Donald Trump with his administration's boundless support for the Saudis, the war began when Joe Biden was incumbent as the U.S. Vice President in the Barack Obama administration.
I mean, I think Biden's silence speaks volumes, right? So since 2015, an administration that he was a part of, he's actively chosen billions and billions of dollars in weapons sales. Corporations have made billions and billions of dollars in sales, and they've decided that that money, right, is more important than the lives of Yemeni people. And it's more important than the child that dies every 75 seconds in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the National Salvation Government. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia is soon to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. Many observers believe that ending the war requires international pressure against Saudi Arabia and its regional allies, especially by their powerful partners, including the United States. But whether or not those nations' wider West Asia policies allow risking their ties with Riyadh is anybody's guess.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
What Biden did not admit is that the United States and its allies, with all their money and firepower, were unable to vanquish the Taliban, who currently control about half of Afghanistan and are positioned to control even more in the coming month without a ceasefire, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article published under the heading, As Biden Plans Withdrawal, Analysis Shows Afghan War Cost at Least 241,000 Lives and $2.26 trillion. Stay tuned for the details, please. In the wake of President Joe Biden's announcement that he plans to withdraw all regular U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan by this year's anniversary of September 11, 2001 attacks, experts at the Cost of War Project recently released an update on what nearly two decades of war has cost in both dollars and human lives. An estimated 241,000 people have died as a direct result of the war, and the United States has spent $2.26 trillion in military operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2001 U.S. invasion, according to the project housed at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs and Boston University's Frederick S. Perdy Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. These horrific numbers are testament to the cost of war, first to the Afghan people and then to the troops and people of the United States, said project co-director and Brown University professor Catherine Lutz in a statement. Ending the war as soon as possible is the only rational and human thing to do, it added. The new Cost of War Project figures are part of a nearly decade-long effort by co-director and Boston University professor Nita Crawford to track the cost of post-9/11 wars in not only Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also Iraq, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and beyond. The death tally includes U.S. military and contractors, Department of Defense civilians, Afghan and Pakistani national military and police, other allied troops, civilians, opposition fighters, journalists, and media workers, and humanitarian aid workers. The project notes that these figures do not include deaths caused by disease, loss of access to food, water, infrastructure, and or other indirect consequences of the war. The financial costs include overseas contingency operations budgets of the U.S. Defense and State Departments, the DOD's base budget war-related increases, veteran care, and estimated interest on money borrowed to fund the war. It does not include future cost of veteran care or future interest payments. The DOD spending at over $900 billion in Afghanistan is a tip of the iceberg, Crawford said. The costs of the Afghanistan war include its escalation into Pakistan, millions of refugees and displaced persons, the toll in lives of combatants and non-combatants, and the need to care for America's veterans. The Pentagon's base budget has increased as well. Report these estimates so that the American people will have a better understanding of the scale of the effort and its consequences, she explained. The American people also lost some transparency here. a more comprehensive accounting is yet to be completed. It would include not just money that may or may not have been well spent, but the count of those wounded, those who lost limbs, and the tremendous psychological toll of decades of war on combatants and non-combatants and their families. The new numbers come after Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Rocana argued recently in an op-ed for the Washington Post that the withdrawal should spark reflection upon the enormous costs of nearly two decades of war and enable the U.S. to refocus on diplomacy as U.S. foreign policy tool of first resort. Executing a responsible and comprehensive withdrawal from Afghanistan is an essential first step toward Biden fulfilling his commitment to end forever wars, the lawmakers wrote. What Biden did not admit is that the United States and its allies, with all their money and firepower, were unable to vanquish the Taliban, who currently control about half of Afghanistan and are positioned to control even more in the coming months without a ceasefire. Nor did Biden admit that, in two decades, the United States and its allies have been unable to build up a stable, democratic, popular government or a competent military in the country. Benjamin and Davis activists also noted that while Biden is being pilloried by some for pulling out too soon, the truth is that he is violating a May 1st deadline for U.S. troops withdrawal that was painstakingly negotiated under Trump administration. And anticipation of that U.S. violation has prompted the Taliban to refuse to join 10 days of United Nations-led peace talks set to start in Istanbul on April 24th. We must hope that in the coming months, the UN will find a way to bring the warring parties in Afghanistan together and craft a ceasefire and a workable peace process based on power sharing, they concluded. After so many decades of war and intense suffering, much of it perpetrated by United States and its allies, the Afghan people desperately need and deserve an end to this war. Communique.
There's been a lot of controversy in the last year regarding the so-called left in the United States. Ever since Bernie Sanders dropped out of the presidential race in 2020, throwing his support behind Joe Biden, and the more recent force the vote controversy among progressives in the Democratic Party. So let's take a closer look at this progressive label and the people supposedly spearheading its movement. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Heralded as a firebrand progressive, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was elected to represent New York's 14th congressional district in 2018. As the youngest congresswoman in U.S. history, she unseated one of the most important figures in the Democratic Party, Joe Crowley, in an upset victory that caught people way off guard and was even featured in a Netflix documentary, Knock Down the House. Along with other progressive newcomers elected to the House in historic races, AOC and her colleagues came to be known collectively as the Squad. This included Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, a Muslim of Somali origin who first came to the United States as a refugee, as well as Michigan's Rashida Tlaib of Palestinian origin, and Ayanna Pressley, becoming the first black woman from Massachusetts to be elected to Congress. Together, they threatened to take on the D.C. political establishment, engaging in bold direct action, holding sit-ins and protesting outside Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office. Indeed, at the time, these self-styled socialists or social democrats seemed to represent a new generation that wasn't afraid to break from traditional liberal orthodoxy.
If you're a one-term Congress member, so what? You can make 10 years worth of change in one term if you're not afraid.
AOC would decry Israel's massacre of Palestinians during the Right to Return marches in 2018-2019 and said that the Democratic Party needed new leadership and need not remain under the old guard of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Indeed, these new faces of the Democratic Party's left wing were not the usual old white men one was accustomed to seeing running the political affairs of the nation, but instead young, vibrant women of color who were willing to play hardball with Democrats and push for universal health care, a $15 minimum wage, action on climate change, and policies rooted in human rights. At least that's how it started. Whether it was the persistent and sustained attacks from Republicans or unrelenting pressure to conform to Democratic leadership, whatever it was, somewhere along the way, these so-called progressives, regarded by many as heroes, became the opposite of everything they had campaigned for. For many people who helped them with their election campaigns, canvassed in the streets, donated their hard-earned money, and put in so much time and energy to get them elected, this felt like a betrayal. The first warning signs began appearing when we heard last year in 2020 from Politico how AOC was firing her former staff that got her elected and replacing them with establishment figures. Not only that, but she wasn't extending support to other progressive challengers for fear of angering her party colleagues. Again, the entire premise of the progressive strategy is to challenge and unseat establishment Democrats. Instead of supporting new challengers, AOC was protecting the party. Now AOC was no longer protesting and holding sit-ins in Speaker Pelosi's office. Now she was calling Nancy Pelosi Mama Bear. Progressives began doing other inexplicable things, like Ilhan Omar voting present on a motion to recognize the Armenian genocide. Ayanna Pressley and Ro Khanna went on to vote in favor of a resolution condemning the Boycott and Divestment Sanction Movement, or BDS, which is a nonviolent, peaceful protest against Israeli apartheid. Ilhan Omar even went on to sign a letter calling on then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to push for a renewal of the arms embargo on Iran before its expiry in late 2020. During the coronavirus crisis, corporations received the largest giveaway in history. The entire U.S. government, both Republicans and Democrats, all voted to give them trillions of dollars. Bernie Sanders and AOC came to the floor to give fiery speeches and pretend that they were outraged that so much money was being given to companies who don't need it, favoring them over working-class Americans who were without jobs, health care, or wages. And in the end, after all that talk, they still voted for the bill. They voted for the CARES Act, the HEROES Act, and virtually every so-called relief package, giving crumbs to the people and the lion's share to corporate America. Now, the latest so-called progressives to be elected to Congress recently include Jamal Bowman to New York's 16th congressional seat. He unseated a longtime ally of the Israeli lobby, Elliot Engel. And in order to prove that he wasn't a threat to Israeli interests, Bowman published an open letter in Riverdale Press confirming that he is opposed to the BDS movement, the most peaceful and nonviolent form of protest that anyone can adopt against Israel's oppression of Palestinians. As a matter of fact, Bowman admitted that former President Barack Obama was so impressed by this open letter that he even called him to endorse his candidacy. Another self-styled progressive named Richie Torres was elected to New York's 15th congressional district.
Hello, I'm Richie Torres. I am Afro-Latino, LGBTQ, millennial, progressive, and pro-Israel.
It's once again so astonishing to me how these politicians claim their politics and policies are rooted in human rights as they continue to protect Israel from any criticism and to be in a party in a government that subsidizes Israel's illegal occupation and oppression of Palestinians. During the 2020 Democratic primaries, when it became clear that Bernie Sanders' agenda became a threat to the Democratic Party, once again, Barack Obama made a few calls behind the scenes, persuading many of the challengers in the field to all drop out and rally behind Joe Biden. Once the race had been narrowed down to just two candidates with the entire weight of the establishment behind Joe Biden, it didn't take long for Bernie Sanders to drop out. Bernie Sanders had prided himself in building a popular grassroots movement made up of all age groups, ethnicities, and backgrounds. Instead of using his popularity and political capital to actually advance the progressive agenda, once again, Bernie Sanders pledged his support behind the establishment pick, Hillary Clinton in 2016, and now Joe Biden in 2020, abandoning his movement. The squad, who for the most part had endorsed Bernie Sanders, also rallied behind Joe Biden. despite Joe Biden's abysmal record of working with segregationists, trying to cut Social Security, supporting the Iraq War, pushing the war on drugs, catering to the credit card industry, to the banks, to Big Pharma, and virtually every branch of the American corporate machine, these so-called progressives decided to endorse him and campaign on his behalf. How could these people who say their politics are all about elevating the working class and upholding human rights, who want Medicare for all, who want to increase Social Security, cut military spending, who stand on the opposite side of Joe Biden on virtually every issue, how can they just casually pledge their support to him? The line that we kept hearing from them and in the media was that, yeah, you know, Joe Biden may be terrible on this issue or that issue, but once he's elected, we'll push him left. We have to elect him because we have no choice. Donald Trump is so terrible. He's an existential threat. He's the most dangerous president in modern history, which, again, as horrible as Donald Trump surely is, that title definitely belongs to George W. Bush and his administration. But, of course, all these neocons were themselves recruited, like Colin Powell speaking at the Democratic National Convention, in order to stump for Joe Biden. So once again, I ask these so-called progressives, how on earth can you remain in a party that brings a war criminal and a mass murderer like Colin Powell to speak at your convention? If neoconservatives like Bill Kristol, George Bush, and other villainous figures like that are siding with you, don't you think there's something fundamentally wrong going on here? The entire media apparatus and Democratic Party acted as if Donald Trump had appeared out of the blue. They conveniently left out the fact that Joe Biden is the reason someone like Donald Trump was elected in the first place. Biden spent his entire career, some 40-plus years in government, building the system, being an architect of the neoliberal policies that eroded manufacturing, that took jobs overseas, deregulated Wall Street and the economy, let corporations run wild, and created so much of the economic misery and turmoil that could allow someone as heinous as Donald Trump to even win over a neoliberal figure like Hillary Clinton in the first place. Once again, the so-called left wing or progressive wing of the Democratic Party, the squad, they proved that they were willing to put their party first, not policies, not principles, nor people. In December 2020, with Speaker Pelosi's re-election as House Speaker coming up, an opportunity arose for progressives in Congress to actually do something. Many pundits, commentators, and journalists on the left, such as Jimmy Dore, Breonna Joy Gray, and NFL player Justin Jackson, argued in favor of force the vote. Earlier in January this year, Nancy Pelosi was re-elected Speaker of the House. With the final tally at 216 to 209, she won against McCarthy by a razor-thin margin of just 7 votes. If progressives had banded together, they could have easily leveraged their votes for her in exchange for a vote on Medicare for All. Instead, they rolled over like faithful, obedient poodles, and every single one of them voted for Nancy Pelosi to be reelected House Speaker without demanding a single concession. Remember, this is the same woman who refused to impeach George Bush over the Iraq War, even when she knew that he was lying about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction. Again, just a month later, in February 2021, progressives had yet again another opportunity to push Biden left, as they claimed they would do. One of the key policies that the squad were elected on in the first place was raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 an hour. Joe Biden made this a campaign promise. Initially, the $15 minimum wage was put into a mammoth piece of legislation containing up to $1.9 trillion in this so-called COVID relief bill. When Biden tried to force this bill through the Senate using budget reconciliation, the Senate parliamentarian, whose opinion is non-binding and merely advisory, said that the $15 minimum wage had to be removed. It was also claimed that Joe Manchin, a senator from West Virginia who was opposed to the $15 minimum wage being in the bill, threatened to vote against it if it was kept in there. Joe Biden pretended that his hands were tied, that he, the most powerful man in the world, the president of the United States, could not do anything because of an unelected Senate parliamentarian and a lone senator from West Virginia. Consequently, the $15 minimum wage was removed from the bill. And when the bill was sent back to the House, it passed. It passed with a razor-thin margin of 9 votes. Just 9 votes. That's all it would have taken for progressives to hold up this must-pass bill. Instead of putting their foot down and saying, no, we refuse to vote for this bill because it doesn't have the $15 minimum wage, the so-called left wing of the Democratic Party, these progressives in Congress, they just accepted it. They voted for this bill, minus the $15 minimum wage. Isn't that interesting how Joe Manchin is willing to play hardball with Biden, but the progressives who claim they fight for workers won't? Not just that, but ever since Biden has taken office, AOC and her colleagues have done nothing but cover for Biden, even as he continues the very same policies they once criticized under Trump. Biden has continued to treat refugees coming to the United States in the same appalling conditions and manners as Donald Trump. Instead of calling him out for this, AOC goes on her virtual town hall and claims that what's happening at the border now is not the same, solely because Biden isn't ripping babies from their mother's arms. That's interesting because under Trump, AOC called the facilities at the U.S.-Mexico border concentration camps, with the phrase kids in cages becoming emblematic of the border crisis. Now those terms have completely disappeared from AOC's vocabulary. Right now, there are over 15,000 unaccompanied minors in custody at the U.S. border in appalling, cramped spaces. Biden has not only reopened the same camps that Donald Trump was using, he is also continuing to separate minors, but instead of doing it on the U.S. side of the border, he makes families do it for him on the Mexican side of the border. Biden refuses to accept families or adults, so the families and adults just tell their children to go on without them. The Washington Times reported in early April that the Department of Homeland Security seeks to continue construction of Trump's border wall, which so many liberals decried as racist and immoral, and now they say nothing. Biden has also requested to increase the military budget to $753 billion. That's the largest in history, even bigger than Trump's. As expected, the so-called progressives in Congress have not said a word. When Biden bombed Syria and now also plans to violate the Afghan peace deal and continue occupying Afghanistan, where is AOC? Where is the squad? Complete silence. Despite being the most popular politicians in the country, they say nothing and allow Biden to proceed unchecked with the imperialist agenda of the U.S. regime. Their silence is not incompetence, it's complicity. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Ryan Knight. He's the host of the Amped Up podcast. Thanks for coming on the show, Ryan. It's great to have you on the program.
Hey, Richard. It's great to be here and great to see you again.
So, Ryan, I wanted to start out with this recent development that we saw in Politico, where Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, is taking money that she fundraised and giving it to establishment Democrats. People like Alyssa Slotkin, Connor Lamb, Carolyn Bordeaux. These are people who've openly celebrated both Trump and Biden's bombings of the Middle East. They've celebrated Trump's assassination of General Soleimani. Straight up warmongers. I mean, what was your initial reaction to that?
AOC and the squad were sent to Congress to fight back against the corrupt system, not to defend it like the corporatists do. And so if we just look at the past week and a half alone, AOC has called socialists and anyone who criticizes Joe Biden, quote unquote, bad faith actors. Then a few days later, she tried to say that Biden's cruelty and inhumanity at the border is somehow better than Trump's cruelty and inhumanity at the border, despite the fact that they both locked children in cages and they both are separating children from their families, except Joe Biden is just doing it on the other side of the border. And then finally, like you just said, the report came out a few days ago, or last Friday, excuse me, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who claims to be just a people-funded grassroots candidate, was taking those grassroots donations and sending them to corporate Democrats who oppose Medicare for All and support endless wars. And this is the part we have to be clear on. Anyone who campaigns on and promises revolutionary change and takes money from poor and working class people to get power and then refuses to use their seat to actually fight for the socialist policies that they campaigned on, that is literally the definition of a bad faith actor, right? So AOC is not leading the left. She's stabbing the left in the back. And we've seen that over and over again now from, you know, go back to January. AOC and the squad did not force the vote on Medicare for All and demand concessions for their vote for Pelosi. They didn't pressure Joe Biden on the $15 minimum wage fight. And again, they continue to apologize for the corrupt establishment instead of fighting back against it. So I'm over here wondering, when does the fight begin?
So, I mean, when you heard this term, bad faith actor, coming from AOC, saying that people who say there's no progress under Joe Biden compared to Trump are privileged in their critique. I mean, who is she referring to when she says that?
Well, I also think we have to step back and realize that the Democrats control the entire government right now. They control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And they're still blaming Republicans for all of our problems, despite the fact that it's not Donald Trump anymore who's dropping the bombs and who's locking the children in cages and who's increasing the military spending and who's putting corporations over people. That's Joe Biden who's doing all those things now. So for AOC to say that those of us, the activists and those in the grassroots community who are fighting back against this corrupt system and demanding representation from people who campaigned on policies, that's all we're doing. AOC and the squad ran on a set of policies. All we're telling them is you need to own up to your promises and fight for the policies you campaigned on. To call us bad faith actors because we see that, Joe Biden is governing the exact same way Trump did, and basically we've just got a kinder face on the oligarchy, but all of the destruction and the damage is continuing that continued under Trump. That is very dangerous. And then we have an entire corporate media apparatus who, when Trump was doing these things, when Trump was locking kids in cages and engaging in endless wars and bombing Syria, the media was up in arms about it. But when Joe Biden does it, they just look the other way. And so that's why it's important for independent media and for people like me and you to hold the Democratic Party accountable, because there's no accountability in the press. And so when AOC did that, when she said that, we're the bad faith actors, and then she, after that, she actually said that we need solidarity. We need to build solidarity with the Biden administration. So AOC is telling us that she wants to build solidarity with the corporate Democrats who are continuing to govern like the Republicans do. They want solidarity with the capitalist right-wing Democratic Party and its leaders, but they don't want solidarity with the grassroots. And that should concern everyone, because that's how change happens. Change happens from the grassroots. And I thought she was leading a movement. It turns out, like I said, she's stabbing the movement right in the back. And I think even sadder, her fans can't see it. There's like this new cult of personality that has developed around AOC. And it's scary.
So Ryan, you've been holding progressives accountable. What are some of the attacks and abuse that you have received or have seen others receive as a result of just calling out these politicians for rolling over and doing the bidding of the establishment?
I've been called racist, misogynist, for simply reporting what AOC did and AOC said, for simply saying that AOC gave grassroots donations to corporate Democrats. There's been people who've told me that AOC is, and I quote, unassailable. And if you look up the word unassailable in the dictionary, it literally means that you can't be questioned or challenged. And if you think that a leader cannot be questioned or challenged, you don't belong to a progressive movement. You belong to a cult of personality movement. Seriously, I mean that. And I think when you start to unpack what it is, I think that a lot of these kind of, the boutique left, or they're really just liberals, to be honest. I think they're so afraid of any criticism of AOC or Bernie or the squad because they've placed all their faith in trying to reform and move the corrupt Democratic Party to the left. So they treat even valid criticisms as an attack on their belief system. But both history and our current reality have shown that the Democratic Party cannot be moved left. You cannot move a party left that is owned by Wall Street and that is owned by the military-industrial complex and that is owned by the billionaire class. And so this whole process of trying to spend all this energy to move a party left that can't be moved left would be much better spent trying to build power for the people outside of the corrupt duopoly. But they don't want to do that. They want to keep putting these heroes on a pedestal and worshiping AOC and worshiping the squad and even in some points worshiping Bernie instead of actually taking matters into our own hands and building power for the people and building like a true left working class party in our country, because we don't have that. Both parties in Washington represent big business and giant corporations. Neither party represent the people.
I mean, this cult of personality, this blind adoration of politicians is obviously not healthy. What do you think are going to be the long-term effects of that? And, just on a final note, What would you like to see from these elected officials and politicians?
I would just end with, why is it fair that in the United States of America that we have two political parties that serve the interests of the capitalist class and of the giant corporations, but zero major parties that serve the interests of the working class? That is not right. That is not fair. And I would just tell people, it is you're never going to change the Democratic Party. They are going to continue to sedate the public with all these platitudes.